Lou Gehrig, the long-dead baseball player, accidentally gave his name to the disease that killed him. Even without the name, though, we'd have the disease. ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, gradually reduces the body's functions, leading to paralysis and often death. ALS is one of several maladies that receives a lot of time and attention at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. Two guests from OHSU join us to talk about progress in diagnosis and treatment and an event coming up to raise money for research. Dr. Shafiq Karam is a neurologist. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Karam.
Thank you.
And Dr. Alan Teo is a psychiatrist, and I need to push his button to make sure he gets online. There he goes. Dr. Teo, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks. Good to join you again, Jeff.
Good to have you both here. Dr. Karam, let's start with you. Since I noticed that you're involved in a lot of reviewing of neurology and neuromuscular journals, that you're probably very much up to speed on research at the moment. Where do things stand with general progress in seeking new treatments or even a cure for ALS?
Yes. So there is actually a lot of research going on, and that's correct. I think it's a little bit too early to talk about cure. I think our research currently is mainly focused on, one, understanding the disease, what's causing the disease, and I think we're making some progress now, especially with the new genetic discoveries. You know, this is a minority of patients who have genetic form of the disease, only 10%, so that would not help most of the patient, but it will help a small portion of the patients.
All right, so when you say 10% genetic, so 10% of people are getting it because it's in their families?
Correct, yeah.
Interesting. What is yet to be understood about the real nitty-gritty molecular-level mechanisms of ALS and how it affects the body?
Well, I think we know a little bit more about ALS when it's genetic form rather than when it's sporadic, meaning that it occurs on chance. You know, when it's genetic, we have many genes now that are very well known and documented to cause ALS. And in these conditions, we can test for specific genetic mutation. And because we know what gene is affected, there's some attempt to do therapies on gene therapy, where you can, for example, silence the gene and tell it not to express the protein that may cause the disease. By accumulating or causing toxicity for the disease. So this is a very interesting area of the research, and it also allowed us to make some mice models that can help us understand what's going on in the disease. Unfortunately, in sporadic form of the disease, it's much more difficult to understand what's going on. There's many factors that come in role, a lot of free oxidative change that can cause damage to the nerves. The body may secrete some toxin that can damage the nerve, or there may be some environmental factor that can cause toxicity for the nerves. So we're not very sure in sporadic diseases what's causing the disease. So and that causes a lot of problems when we're doing clinical trials. If you don't really understand the disease very well, it's very hard to find a cure.
Is even within the sporadic form, is there any accounting for genes turning on and off that account for that, or is it strictly apart from anything genetic at that point?
Yeah, it's not like the genetic forms where you have definitely a gene that is causing the disease. It's a little bit more complicated than that. I think there's definitely probably a predisposition for the patient, but then there's something else that goes on and that kind of triggers the disease. For example, very new research have found that maybe some old viruses that were inherited as we were evolving, viruses can be incorporated in the DNA of humans, and sometimes reactivation of this virus can cause progression of disease. So this is one theory, and there's been new research on that just recently published.
Dr. Alan Teo is with us as well, a psychiatrist at OHSU. Dr. Teo, I understand that there are professional and personal connections to ALS for you. Let's start with the professional. Is there a whole realm of psychiatry and psychology helping people who have conditions like ALS deal with them?
Yeah, it's absolutely true that patients with many sorts of medical conditions, chronic conditions, or illnesses like ALS that are particularly stressful, these are... ALS is a terminal illness, meaning there's no cure. disorder, and people will die from it, unfortunately. And so there's a lot of psychological ramifications, and certainly depression, for instance, is one of the common co-occurring illnesses that occurs with the ALS.
I notice a fair amount of your work deals with things like isolation and suicide prevention and social withdrawal, described in Japan as hikikomori. And I can imagine something like ALS is just the thing to lead to greater isolation for a lot of people.
Yeah, there could be that risk. Fortunately, what we do see, and also in terms of my own personal experience with ALS in my family, the family unit is so incredibly important and so incredibly helpful. So, for instance, with some of the work that our local ALS Association chapter is doing, a lot of that involves both the patient with ALS, but a lot of support services also for the family members. And in my own research, again, in the psychiatry world, we see that bolstering social support and connections is often very good for patients' outcomes.
I understand you're actually going to be in this ride to defeat ALS on Saturday in Mount Angel.
Yeah, exactly so. We're going to be riding through some of the beautiful Oregon countryside. That my mother and actually my grandfather had ALS, and so I benefited from a lot of the support services that I was mentioning with this ALS Association. And then more recently, I've sort of come to realize, gosh, I need to do more to give back, and I benefited a lot, my family benefited a lot, and I've wanted to get involved. And so one way that I've been able to do that is with this Ride to Defeat ALS, and so that will be this Saturday and in and around that area of Mount Angel.
Which is in the Salem area for the folks who are not familiar. We're talking about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, with a couple of scientists from Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Alan Teagoe is a psychiatrist. Shafiq Karam is a neurologist. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, or stories of your own to share at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I mean, obviously not a lot of people have heard about things like the Ride to Defeat outside the immediate, Portland area, but we're just 2 years now since the Ice Bucket Challenge, when it seemed like everybody knew a little bit about ALS. Has there been a continued level of awareness increased, or has the knowledge of ALS sunk back down a bit, Dr. Karam?
I think the Ice Bucket was just tremendous, just an amazing experience. Everybody heard about ALS, people who never heard or never had interaction with patients with ALS or didn't have family members have ALS just learned about it and went and tried to look online what's happening and what's causing it. And, of course, participating in the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, which raised a lot of money for research and that scientists are actually currently using for research. So I wish this would happen every year. Unfortunately, it just trended 1 year mainly. But I think, people became aware of this condition, and I think more people are interested in learning more about it right now.
It's often been said that disease that has more people who deal with it is going to get greater funding and research. What are the current numbers about people with ALS in the United States, for example?
Yeah, as ALS is a rare disease. There's only a few thousand of people who have it in the U.S., and because of that, it's hard to do studies on it because it's rare and it's hard to enroll patients in the studies. But also it's hard to get a lot of funding for this condition.
Just to add a little bit of local information, too, here in Oregon we have probably about 400, 450 or so families that are living with ALS at any one time. And, of course, then many others spread across the U.S., but that's what it looks like here locally.
And you've, as you mentioned, through your own family experience, you've gotten familiar with some of the services. What are some of the things that are available to the people, the patients of ALS and their families, Dr. Teagoe?
Yeah, it's a wonderful array of different services. So some of that on the sort of there's both a short-term and a long-term strategy. So the long-term strategy that I think Dr. Karam is alluding to is the research. The research needs to go on. The ALS Association funds millions and millions of dollars of research each year. And that's a long-term plan because research moves forward slowly. The short-term plan, I would say, is for immediate help to families and patients with ALS. So some of the services I benefited, for instance, with my family, was sort of nurses and other social workers coming into our home, different support group services. There's also a lot of gaps with even with someone with insurance. And so even if you have really excellent health insurance, you're going to end up with a lot of your own out-of-pocket costs. And so the ALS Association will help with that. You know, one of the estimates that I've heard is that the costs for ALS to a patient or their family can be upwards of $100,000 or $200,000 a year. So ALS strikes people that are of all ethnicities, people that are rich and poor. But even if you are rich, you're probably going to be in a lot of trouble with ALS. It's a hard and costly illness.
Dr. Karam, how long do people usually live with ALS after the initial diagnosis?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's another thing with ALS. It's a very heterogeneous disease. So people face the disease and live with the disease very differently. Some people, unfortunately, die within a month of diagnosis, and some other live really much longer, 10, 20 years sometimes. But the majority will live anywhere between 2 to 5 years after the diagnosis.
Which, Dr. Teo, creates an issue for anybody trying to deal with the mental well-being of somebody whose body is failing on them over time. I mean, what kinds of approaches can psychology take for people who know that the end is not far away and have to deal with the progressive debilitation on the way to it?
Yeah, so I think some of that is going through that process of acceptance and bereavement and having as much of a discussion with the family to the extent that a patient would want the family involved, but family involvement and discussion so that everyone is on the same page. Being flexible, as Dr. Kram was alluding to, there's a lot of varieties. For some people, the illness progresses more quickly, very rapidly. For others, it's more slowly. And so being flexible in terms of adapting to your own individual circumstances with the illness, a lot of those sort of, I think, responses and adaptive responses you can learn through more psychological training and psychiatric help.
We're talking about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, with Dr. Alan Teo, psychiatrist at Oregon Health and Science University, and Dr. Shafiq Karam, a neurologist there. You can join our discussion on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Karam, I want to come back to the viruses. You were talking about that before, about it seems like from what I've read in the past, we have a lot of old busted parts of viruses still within ourselves, don't we?
Yeah, that's correct, and very interesting, actually. And, you know, they probably play a lot of roles in diseases, not only ALS, but different kind of diseases.
And so I'm curious to know about the kind of help that I mean, we're talking about the ALS Society and a lot of what it does, but how much help does the Centers for Disease Control provide in research into ALS, for example?
I think they provide a lot of help, especially in the you know, the registry that they have currently, where people can go and sign up, and, you know, it helps us understand more about the how many patients are actually the true number of the incidence for ALS. You know, in for infection itself, I don't think that we're there yet. This is what I was talking about. Research at the NIH is very recent, and it's very interesting, although. And there's something very interesting is that sometimes patients with HIV, when they first get the disease, they can present just like typical ALS. And that's why we really check for HIV in patients with ALS. And then when you treat the HIV, the symptoms of ALS regress and the patient can become strong again. And that's actually a very interesting thing. Just tells you that things can look like ALS, but they can be caused by things that are treatable. And that's always a challenge for us to make sure that we're not really missing something that we can treat. And the new research on the retrovirus that are incorporated in our genes is also very interesting, although we do know that a trial on retrovirus in ALS did not really work. Was done back a few years ago in New York, and unfortunately it was negative. But I don't know, with this new data that we have from the NIH, how things are going to move forward.
What is the difference between a standard virus and a retrovirus?
Well, the retrovirus, they're very different. I don't claim to be an expert in HIV, but retrovirus just go into cells and causes damage to the lymphocyte and you know, suppress the immune system in HIV and AIDS patients.
Given that, you know, we still call this Lou Gehrig's disease a lot, I think the life of Lou Gehrig is so intimately involved with our understanding of ALS. Did the disease, do we believe, exist long before his time? Is it something that has existed throughout history? I mean, are we able to go back and look at journals and diaries and figure out that people are describing what probably was ALS long before Lou Gehrig?
I think, you know, the earliest that I'm aware of is, of course, Charcot, who was in France at the Salpêtrière Hospital, and he was really the first person to gather a group of patients and describe this condition of ALS. Of course, before that, a few conditions have been reported, and, you know, if you go and read them, it's like, yeah, this looks like ALS. So, but I think really it was mainly in the 19th century when Charcot described this condition, and we start getting more interested in it. Of course, in the U.S., Lou Gehrig, having gotten ALS, have raised a lot of awareness, and that's why he, you know, gave his name to the disease. And people now, a lot of patients know Lou Gehrig more than ALS itself.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Teo, when I was talking to you about support for the patients of ALS, people have it. I kind of skipped past the other part. And I know you alluded to this already, though, but talk about the importance of support for members of the family. I mean, they're not the ones dealing immediately with the disease in their own bodies, but they're dealing with it in someone they love. So, I mean, what are some of the important steps for people to take if they have ALS in the family to deal with their own health and well-being?
Yeah, I think it's the family's role or responsibility could be taking care of themselves and also doing their best to take care of the person with ALS. I know when my mother had ALS, I was in high school and the end of middle school, and I wasn't as mature in dealing, I think, in responding to the illness as I could. I had, for instance, there were times when I was embarrassed to go out with my mother, and I feel really terrible about that. I feel ashamed about that now, and I think, you know, if I had better engaged with illness, again, using resources like the ALS Association, I think they can help family members know how to monitor their own health, take care of their own health, but also how to best support, best love their, you know, family member with ALS.
For patients and families, has technology made some gains? I mean, you can't change much about the disease, obviously, but you can change mobility and connectivity and things like that in the age of the Internet and microprocessors and all that stuff. I wonder if that has come a long way just in the last couple of decades.
Yes, and there's a lot of support for, again, this is one of the gaps that I was mentioning with health insurance, but there are the ALS Association and others may help with communication and assistive technology devices. So some people may be familiar, for instance, with Stephen Hawking and others who use movements of their eyeballs, essentially, to help communicate and speak. And so that would be one example of advances in sort of making the best. Again, we can't change the course of the illness yet. We're going to fight the long, hard fight to defeat ALS. But in the meantime, we can make the most out of the time that people have, and, for instance, maximizing their ability to communicate. My family had support, for instance, with diet, because eating becomes a tremendous challenge. So ways to sort of enjoy food better and safely consume food without, you know, without causing damage. There are lots of ways to sort of make the day-to-day rhythm of ALS more tolerable and more happy.
Dr. Karam, speaking of diet, we did talk to a couple of people at OHSU recently about diet and MS. I wonder if there are any changes with the onset of ALS based on any dietary restrictions or considerations.
Yeah, that's a good question, and we don't know. We know that diet is very important, and you know, ALS does affect the swallowing muscle, and at some point patients will have a lot of difficulty swallowing. They have to modify their diet, at some point, unfortunately, have a tube through their stomach so they can continue to feed themselves. We also know that patients with ALS lose a lot of weight. We don't really know why, maybe because the disease is hypermetabolic and patients lose weight, but also because they cannot eat as much and their muscle are wasting. So we know that nutrition is extremely important, and that's why we focus on it. We weigh the patient every time they come to the ALS clinic and make sure that they don't need a supplement or something like that to kind of help with maintaining their weight. We also know that patients who lose weight faster unfortunately have a poorer prognosis, and they may die earlier.
Have there been some false starts? Have there been some moments when researchers like yourself thought, hey, we're onto something here, and then it turned out to be not as good as you might have thought?
Yes. That, unfortunately, that happens very frequently, and that's why we have over 50 failed trials in ALS. So that's a lot of money spent, time spent, and false hopes for different molecules. And the reason is, again, because we don't really understand the disease. And when we try these molecules, we usually try them on a mouse model that has one gene defect. And, you know, what may apply to the mouse and to this specific gene may not necessarily apply to humans. So it's very, really difficult. And a lot of time we are, unfortunately, disappointed.
Well, a lot of work ahead of us, but it's good to know that you guys are on it, among many others. The Ride to Defeat ALS, Saturday, July 9th in Mount Angel. Dr. Alan Teo, psychiatrist at OHSU, will be there. Dr. Shafiq Karam, thank you for joining us today, neurologist as well, here on the Jefferson Exchange. Good to have you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.